I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. George Garrett joins me again. The legendary reporter is kind enough to come on as I start the 17th year of the program to talk about what the last 6 months of living through the pandemic has been like for him. He remains plugged in and astute to, as to the politics around us, and literally plugged in, making appearances for various programs and organizations using Zoom, for example, from his home in South Surrey, where he joins me from today. We'll talk about what he's been doing to keep safe and healthy amidst the coronavirus around us. As well, I might get his views on politics at home and abroad. He's a guy who needs no introduction. Folks in these parts know him for his many years as a reporter at CKNW, as well as his two books, The Life and Times of Lighthouse McNeil, An Adventure in the RCMP, and his best-selling memoir, George Garrett, Intrepid Reporter. He has long been associated with the Volunteer Cancer Drivers Association, an organization he helped found. I'll ask him about their efforts and his recent leave-taking there. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, George Garrett. Mr. Garrett, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yourself?
Fine, thank you. I want to congratulate you going into another year of podcasts.
It's year 17. Yeah, it's a long time.
How many interviews?
Today you are 1841.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I just think it's wonderful. You've gained so much knowledge, and you've helped a lot of people.
Well,
you are well read, sir. You have a few books.
Well, thank you very much. We've been able to keep in touch over the last 6 months, but I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to us who might be wondering how you are. Might you have a message for them?
Oh, just hang in there. I know that it's a burden for a lot of people. You know that the calls to homes for battered women are, mm-hmm. have increased to the point where some of them are full and there's no other place to go. Calls on the suicide line are up. A lot of people are depressed. I'm lucky. I'm kind of a positive thinking guy and always have been. My wife is in the care home with Alzheimer's, and I had not been able to see her for about 3 months,
mm-hmm.
but now I can once a week. Unfortunately, she does not communicate with me. She's unable to, and usually she's asleep within a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I get to see her, and that's important.
So what was it like for you? Because I've known you for a while, and you're always out and about and busy. Those first few months, I mean, were you literally locked down? Were you in isolation?
No, I wasn't. I got out quite a bit, although a couple of things I'm involved in, mm-hmm. like the Rotary Club and the Provost Club, are now done by Zoom,
mm-hmm.
and the same for my church, and I'm responsible for contacting a few people from the church on a sort of a semi-regular basis to see how they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've physically been able to get around, and I hadn't been invited for lunch or dinner until recently, and I scored on Friday. I was at lunch at friends of mine in Maple Ridge, and dinner at friends of mine in Delta. So I thought I was doing quite well.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. Yeah, and we'll see each other soon.
Oh yes.
This time has been just a unique time in our history, and it's something that's affected everybody. Unfortunately, it hasn't affected everybody in equal degree, because I think a lot of us who are doing well seem to have done well with it, and then unfortunately the have-nots, if you will, have been hit quite hard by it all. What have you made of how we've seemed to, unfortunately a lot of people have died,
yeah.
But we've sort of made it through this experience, and I'm wondering what that means for us in terms of just how we'll be able to handle things like this in the future, because unfortunately this won't be the last pandemic, right?
No, and this one isn't really over.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're still looking at certainly into next year, maybe even beyond that. And the unfortunate thing is that although the government of British Columbia, I think, has done an outstanding job, particularly Adrian Dix and Dr. Bonnie Henry, there are people who will not listen. And it's particularly an age group from the 20s to their 40s who have become victims of the virus,
mm-hmm.
because they have done foolish things like get together for parties. The beach party is well known. The banquet halls, now they've been closed down. And I don't think that they realize that this business of wearing a mask or washing your hands, using you know, sanitation for your hands, mm-hmm. or sanitizers. These things are important. Now, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't always wear a mask, but if I'm going into a store, quite often I will, or if I know I'm going to be in contact with someone like a cashier or a teller, I don't want to have the risk of spreading my germs to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I do wear a mask, and of course I wash my hands a lot. These are simple things, but there are many people in society who just haven't caught it, haven't realized how bad it can be. Quebec, Ontario, mm-hmm. now in British Columbia, and particularly in the United States. You know, Trump just had a rally down in Nevada mm-hmm. just last night, or the other night,
mm-hmm.
Where people were not wearing masks, and they were very, very close together. So I think it's just a failure of people to recognize that this is for real, and it's not going away soon.
Yeah, yeah. You're someone who has a keen sense of history. Can the experience of the last 6 months, can that compare to any other time, say, that you might have experienced yourself even?
No. I know we had the flu epidemic and so on a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
but it was nothing like this. In my knowledge and my experience, you know, and I'm 85 years old, I haven't experienced anything like this. I was on a tour of Britain once, and I went to a churchyard as part of going through a cemetery, and I was struck by the number of headstones for young men from the World War I,
mm-hmm.
all about the same time. And it wasn't from being wounded in the war. It was what became known as the Spanish flu.
Mm.
It had nothing to do with Spain, but...
Yeah.
Britain wouldn't allow any publicity about the flu epidemic. Spain did. They had no restriction on it, so it became the Spanish flu in the 1917-18 era, I think it was.
Yeah.
I think, the worst, most recent one, and this one tops that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the government in British Columbia a moment ago, and they have been good, but far from perfect, obviously. I'm interested in this idea of leadership, especially leadership in a time of crisis, because we really see our leaders.
Yes.
Some have done well, some have not.
Well, some have surprised me, like Doug Ford in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he's done particularly well,
yeah.
and perhaps the Premier of Quebec. But in British Columbia, I thought John Horgan had an understanding of how to handle it. He delegated authority to the health minister, Adrian Dix, and to Bonnie Henry, our chief health officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was content to let them do their work. And occasionally he would come before the media. But he wasn't a media star, I think, by design. I think he wanted to stay a little bit in the background. And if you look at an example of all the provinces across Canada, perhaps anywhere in North America, we've done the best. And, you know, Adrian Dix, in my opinion, has risen to the occasion. I kind of put him down when he lost the leadership, or at least the election,
mm-hmm.
to Christy Clark, when he made a big mistake. But aside from that, I think he's a policy wonk. He reads everything, he understands, and he's absolutely dedicated. So high marks to him.
Well, when you look at the President of the United States, though, that's someone who has not risen to the occasion.
Anything but.
Yeah.
You know, this latest book by Bob Woodward, based on 18 interviews with Trump, interviews that Trump knew were being recorded. He had Bob Woodward had permission for that. And among other things, you know, in effect, he said, well, I knew it would be bad, but I didn't want to panic people, so I didn't tell the public. And now they're trying to blame Woodward for not telling the public.
Yeah.
It's the president's job, I think. You know, and in the United States, it won't be long before there are 200,000 deaths from it. How many of those could have been prevented?
Right.
How many illnesses could have been prevented? I think, you know, the deaths of those people are on his conscience, or should be.
Yeah, did you have a sense of how it'll end up in November with regards to the election?
I have hopes that it will be a victory for Joe Biden,
mm-hmm.
But there are some elements that frighten me, and I think the Trump people are going on this aspect of I'm for law and order. If you elect the Democrats, you won't have law and order. And there's so many scary elements to that, one of them being the emergence of vigilantes.
Mm.
There are people who I've just saw a television story about it recently, where there are a number of people who, you know, believe in the right to bear arms, but they're carrying semi-automatic rifles, very dangerous weapons, and their common interest is in gun ownership and in supporting Trump. And they're showing up in cities, allegedly to put down the rioting, and I think it's a very, very dangerous situation. And if Trump lost the election, who knows what might happen. I've never seen the United States in such a terrible situation. And it's compounded now, of course, in the West by the forest fires, which have claimed several lives. It's not a good time for the United States, and for that matter, for many countries of the world, you know, about India and Brazil and so on,
mm-hmm.
very high rates of COVID.
And, you know, I heard a comment where Trump said, you know, people should be glad that he was elected because it's not boring. And you know, it's not a really great reason to elect a president. But
no.
I guess being at home, as we, most of us have been, watching him every day, I guess, has been, it's given us something to do. And it's certainly following politics in the States is something that a lot of people have been forced to do, right?
Well, it's not been boring. It's been jaw-dropping at times with some of the statements he has made. The one about he didn't like or wouldn't honor people killed in the war or wounded or any war, and his refusal to go to a ceremony regarding World War I. And the real reason apparently was he didn't want to get his hair wet.
Right.
Well, I'm thinking, how about taking an umbrella? But some of the statements he makes, you know, the news people just can't believe it. But I blame television for getting Trump elected, because even in 2015, a year before that election,
mm-hmm.
he was on television all the time. CNN were opposed to him, but they gave him a lot of coverage. And, you know, CNN and the other one,
Fox,
are, to me, they're not really news programs anymore. They are advocacy programs, Fox particularly for in favor of Trump. And if you watch CNN, you'll see Trump knocked almost every day. He gets very little credit for anything. Fox gives him credit for everything and then some.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they ceased to claim to be news networks, if they ever were.
What on this idea of the media? Because we've been following what's been happening around us through the local media here in Vancouver and British Columbia. How have you found the local media in terms of their coverage of this worldwide story that obviously hits close to home?
I think it's been pretty good, particularly television, and I would single out Global. I happen to watch them the most. And Keith Baldry, I think, has really had a handle on the story from right from the beginning. And if you listen to his stories, he's almost telling you what the next move is without claiming, you know, I've got a tip, etc., etc. He's not exploiting it.
Mm-hmm.
He's just giving us, I think, a sense of what this just means today, what Dr. Henry said, or the minister said, and he puts it all in perspective. And the other fellow, his partner in Victoria, Richard Zussman,
mm-hmm.
equally does a good job. And I think in the newspapers, my hat's off to Vaughn Palmer and Rob Shaw from The Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Vaughn is the best newsman in the province and has been for a long time. But he does put things into perspective. Sometimes he upsets the governing party or the opposition, but that's his job.
Yeah. You mentioned my books off the top. I enjoy watching Baldry's pieces because you can see the books in his background there in his office.
And one of them is Murder by Milkshake.
That's right, yeah.
And that's by Eve Lazarus,
Indeed.
Who's a friend of mine.
Indeed, yeah.
And she's coming to lunch with me shortly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she told me that, she said, Global is going to call you to do an interview about Murder by Milkshake. because she had just done one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And sure enough, I got a call from Ted Chernecki, who sent over a cameraman, who set up my picnic table in the backyard on the lawn, set up my umbrella, set me up for an interview, and Ted Chernecki called, and I saw him on his cell phone.
Yeah.
So it's the way it works these days. You know, the reporter doesn't come out necessarily. But I was given an opportunity to talk about Murder by Milkshake.
Because you knew Castellani, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a white spot, which is no longer there, the one at Gladstone and Kingsway.
Oh, yeah.
And on the north side of Kingsway. I was there on a Sunday working, taking a brief, you know, a hamburger or something. And I saw Rennie, and he was taking a milkshake up to his wife in Vancouver General Hospital. No way of knowing that eventually that milkshake would be laced with arsenic. And it was done several times. And I just can't imagine anyone, no matter who it is. I can understand somebody in an act of fury or immediate reaction doing something terrible. But to deliberately poison a person, your own wife in this case, and to do that deliberately week after week, knowing that she's suffering terribly, it's just inconceivable that anybody could do that.
Yeah, and you did you meet the wife at all?
No, I never did.
Yeah,
but I knew the other lady and his wife,
Lolly,
our switchboard operator at night, and he was attracted to her not only because she was a young widow, her husband had been killed in a boat accident. But she also had some insurance money, $25,000, that he was interested in.
Yeah.
Even went to the point of taking her to a bank and posing as though they were married, even though his wife was still alive and very sick, and wanting to apply for a mortgage.
When you worked with him, as you did at CKNW, did you have a sense of who this guy was? And I mean, it's easy, I guess, in retrospect to put it all together, but... At the time, I mean, do you think he was at all strange, perhaps?
No, he was a brilliant guy. He was creative, he could do anything, he was very outgoing, kind of a type A personality. And he, for instance, won promotion, CKNW had him posing as the Maharaja of Alibaba, wearing a turban, and he looked the part because he's dark-skinned, and he pulled it off, and the idea was that he had come to British Columbia to buy the whole province. He was so wealthy.
Yeah.
And Premier Bennett was not about to sell the province.
Yeah.
It was a promotion by CKNW to match something that CKLG were doing. They had a guy dressed up as a millionaire giving out money all over the market area.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The days of competitive radio.
Yeah. But the other thing that... I don't know if I think it's in Eve's book. You met him because he was sentenced to prison. He was, I guess he was sentenced to death, but then by that point the death penalty had been.
Canada, you know, had a habit of a policy of commuting death sentences to life imprisonment. Uh-huh. So he was sentenced to life imprisonment, and I just thought he'll stay there forever. But
right. In
Canada, if you serve, I think it's two-thirds of your sentence, you can apply for parole. And he really charmed the people in the prison. He helped them organize events, social events within prison. The staff loved him. And he got out on day parole. And the surprise for me was going to a radio station in Abbotsford and just paying a visit. And from inside the offices and out comes this tall fellow, and he said, "Hi, George." And I was shocked as though I'd seen a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "George, it's me, Rennie. It's okay. I'm on parole." But he died a few years after that of cancer.
We've wandered off here in talking about this, but it really is a testament to Eve's great book, Murder by Milkshake. She really was able to write so well about this case, these people.
Yes, Eve did an excellent job. She's a very good writer, you know. She's done books on Vancouver history,
right. Mm-hmm.
Particularly crime. And she established a relationship with Rennie's daughter, Jeanette, who was just a young girl when this all happened. She was even forced to lie at the second trial at the urging of from the instructions from Rennie's lawyer, who's now deceased. But the poor girl had to lie to say that, no, it wasn't my dad that did it, it was my aunt. It was a horrible thing. It just shocked the family.
Yeah.
And then after the trial was over and Rennie had gone to jail, she was with the Castellani family, still influenced by them. Unfortunately, she was hit by a car.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It happened to be a police car driven by a fellow I knew. I think he was in a pursuit of something, but she was, as a pedestrian, she was hit by the car, and she was quite badly injured. And the policeman felt so badly, he took her some roses in the hospital.
Yeah.
And it just felt terrible. But eventually, Jeanette got a settlement from the insurance. Rennie, once out of jail, demanded the money.
Mm.
And, of course, she would not give it to him. So he would not speak to her for the rest of his life.
It's the last time they saw each other, yeah. It was when she rebuffed his request for the money, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about this time is you've mastered Zoom in a way that I haven't been able to at all. I mean, you mentioned these organizations that you're involved with, and you've been meeting, as you said, through Zoom. How have you found that? I mean, it doesn't beat actually meeting people in person, but it sort of helped bridge a gap, hasn't it, in terms of...
It does. I used to tell young reporters that the best way of operating is to get to meet people face-to-face. Then you can phone them for convenience, but make sure you meet them. But so... making a live presentation, as I've done many times, is so much more rewarding because you get a response immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm what they call the sergeant at arms with Rotary temporarily, while another fellow was unable to do it. And I said to the president, I don't really want to tell the joke or try to tell jokes as they're supposed to do, because how do you get a reaction on Zoom?
Mm-hmm.
You can't. So instead, I said, how about if I do a little flashback, something about Vancouver's history? And he said, yes, go for it. So I did one about the best convention in the province's history, the SOCRED convention of 1986. And then I did another story last week about the penthouse, telling the story of how Joe Filippone and his brothers were convicted of living off the avails, but it was overturned on appeal. And also the story of Joe's death. Tragically, he was shot to death in a robbery attempt. And I covered it. I was there almost as soon as the police were. And I remember the break I got was seeing a fellow across the street standing in a parking lot looking at the ground. So I walked over to him and I said, hi, how's it going? He said, George, it's me, Jimmy. They just shot my brother Joe. He's dead.
Uh-huh.
And I asked him if he knew who might have done it, and he named Sid Morrisrule.
Oh, yeah.
Who turned out to be the guy who was convicted,
right,
along with another person.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned the SOCRED 1986 convention. Recently, Alan Fotheringham died. And our friend, Alex Waterhouse Hayward, the photographer, who incidentally, whose photograph is on the cover of your memoir.
Yes.
He did a blog post about his experiences with Fotheringham over the years, and he had a photograph that he took at Whistler, 9 a.m. in the morning, that row of where the media is sitting.
Yes.
And Fotheringham's got the paper out, and he's got he's cracking open a can of kokanee beer at 9 a.m.
That would be Fotheringham. I used to love reading him. I thought he was a great writer.
Yeah.
And I knew his lawyer, Peter Butler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who got him out of several jams because Fotheringham played it close to the line many, many times. And I don't think it was sued successfully very often, partly because of Peter Butler. But he was a guy that could really, annoy the politicians. In fact, there's a little story that he annoyed the management of the hotel, Chateau Laurier, in Ottawa so mm-hmm. much that the then manager said, throw him out, which they did.
we're hearing talk of a federal election even, a provincial one certainly. I mean, there's a lot of chatter about that. How do you think those will play out in the midst of a pandemic?
I would say there's no appetite for elections by the public, either federally or provincially. And as you know, political parties are polling all the time.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily release the polls to us, but my guess is that they would be, the Liberals in Ottawa would be hesitant to call an election, and the other three parties would be, they could force it if they wanted to, but they're not in a position financially, I believe, and maybe the Conservatives are a little better off than the others, but I don't think the NDP wants it just now.
Yeah.
And so I doubt that Trudeau would call an election, at least at this time. And provincially, probably a better chance here, but Mr. Horgan's popularity is pretty high right now for good reason. But once again, I'm wondering if the people really want an election. And the Green Party situation is fluid, a new leader being announced. And that agreement that the NDP and the Green had was supposedly ironclad. And now the Premier is saying, well, that was before COVID. So my question is, what difference does that make?
Yeah.
However, time will tell. But my guess is that we'll not go to the polls until at least the spring.
Yeah, I guess the excuse that I've been hearing, both federally and provincially, is that the governments are set to spend a great deal of money and feel that one of the reasons for an election is the need for a mandate from the people to spend as such.
Yeah, and I've read John Iveson, the National Post, I think a terrific columnist, and he's anticipating that there will be a new and heavier levy for the environment on gas prices.
Mm.
The gas prices will go up again because of the green agenda the government wants to follow.
I'm not in favor of an election, but I figure it'll be a boon for my button collection.
It would be, yes.
I know. Of all the things that you've done in your long life and career, George, this association with the volunteer cancer drivers, is that something that you're proudest of, say?
Yes, I am. It started because in 2015, the Canadian Cancer Society suddenly announced by letters to their patients that we can no longer take you to the hospital or to the treatment center. And I had been a driver myself until my wife got Alzheimer's, so I quit being a driver for the Canadian Cancer Society. But the fellow who trained me still had my phone number. And when he found out about the cancellation by Canadian Cancer, he was furious. And he and the fellow named, his name was John McInnes, and he and Garth Pinton decided to form a new society. They brought me in because they said, you know the media, you can help us get coverage. And it kind of worked that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we did form a new society. 2016, we started carrying patients. And we did so every weekday until the COVID crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We were forced to suspend service for 3 months beginning in March. But we were back again June 22nd, resuming our service. So I'm very proud of what we've been able to do. It's not just me, of course. It's a team, a wonderful executive of nine people. And now there's eight because I just resigned and retired, but I think that I was in at the early stages and helping to raise money, and I kind of annoyed people. It's like when I was a reporter, you knew that some people didn't want to see you coming. Or they'd like to see you leave.
Right, right. but I mean, and I only know this because I'm a contributor as well, a minor contributor. But you all have raised, what is it, over $1 million since the last 4 years or so?
Yes, I was surprised at my little retirement luncheon at the White Spot out here. My treasurer announced that we had raised, I think it was $1.3 million.
Wow.
I know that we're very, very secure for now.
Mm-hmm.
The one I mentioned, John McInnes, about a year or so after we started, he was diagnosed with cancer himself, and within a matter of a few weeks he died. And he had always said, I want this to last for 25 years. So that was always in the back of my mind, that we're going to have something that lasts. And now we're in a position where I know that we're good for a few years at least.
Yeah, and although you are retired, you remain a great supporter of the organization, right?
Yes, well, I want to do two things. I'm away from the day-to-day fundraising, but by example, I think, is the best way to do it. So I've made a donation to the Volunteer Cancer Drivers of stock, you know, equities.
Right.
And there's an advantage to that because it means that if you get credit for an income tax receipt for the amount that the stock was worth, but you don't pay capital gains on it if you have made money on the stock. So it's an easy thing to do, and it's a win-win situation. And the other thing I have done is just last week I went to a lawyer in White Rock and redid my will, and I've included money for the volunteer cancer drivers. But I did tell my president, I hope he don't collect that for a long time.
And for a lot of us, hopefully not. Yeah.
Thank you.
But that's something that's easy for a lot of people to do, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And the stock thing especially, because it's not something that people think of, because the money isn't. It's not something you see, I guess, and so
that's right. No,
it's easy to do, and then of course adding something to your will. It doesn't have to be, it could be various organizations that one can help afterwards, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, the stock situation is a lot of people will give money to it, which is great, giving cash. They get a receipt for it. But if a person has some holdings of stock, then they can sell off a little bit. Particularly one stock that they made a gain on, and avoid paying the capital gains tax and still get credit for the donation.
Yeah. George, I've kept you longer than I said I would, but it's just delightful to chat as always, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to us who are happy to hear your voice. I appreciate this, and we'll see each other soon.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe.
George Garrett joined me on the line from Surrey in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.